From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the challenges of shooting on location in Thailand, Colombia, and India. We talk with Roland Jaffe, the director of The Killing Fields, The Mission, and City of Joy, a new film set in the slums of Calcutta. Also, writer Richard Rayner tells us how his father stole a lot of money, faked his own death, and disappeared. Rayner's new novel is about a father like his own. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new albums by Bruce Springsteen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A powerful bomb has exploded in London's financial district, the area known as the City. Preliminary reports indicate at least two people dead and 30 injured. NPR's John Idstey reports.
What was apparently a car bomb went off just after 9 p.m. tonight, rocking part of the financial district, where many office staff were still in pubs celebrating the end of the election campaign. Police were reportedly given a 20-minute warning over the telephone by a person with an Irish accent, but the authorities were unable to evacuate the area. The caller used a code word often given by the Irish Republican Army. For years, the IRA has been pursuing a campaign of terror aimed at ending British rule in Northern Ireland. There's been an increase in IRA activity in London in the past 6 months. In late February, a bomb exploded at the busy London Bridge Underground station, injuring 28, but killing no one. I'm John Idstey in London.
The president of Bosnia-Herzegovina appealed today for international help to protect Muslims in the eastern part of the republic from ethnic Serbian militiamen. There was heavy fighting reported today in the parts of Bosnia that share a border with Serbia. Observers say the Serbs appear to be trying to capture a sizable amount of territory, as they did in the neighboring Republic of Croatia. President Alija Izetbegović appealed to the United Nations and the European community to help end the violence, saying that Muslims were being massacred by Serb militias. Bosnia's Muslims and Croats have voted overwhelmingly to separate from the Yugoslav Federation, but Serbs want to remain united with the Republic of Serbia. The PLO leader Yasser Arafat has returned to Tunis after escaping death in a plane crash in the Sahara Desert. Arafat arrived in Tunis from Tripoli, where he'd been hospitalized. Al Fermita reports from Tunis.
The PLO leader landed at Tunis in a Libyan plane to be greeted by a brass band and the presidential guard. Wearing battle fatigues as usual, Arafat looked remarkably well, considering his ordeal in the Sahara. The bandage over the right side of his head was gone, revealing a bruised and half-opened eye. Arafat walked down the steps from the plane unaided, to be welcomed by the Tunisian president and high-ranking PLO officials, before disappearing in a black limousine. Arafat is likely to undergo further medical checks, but PLO officials say he'll be back at work very soon, and he is due to meet the Egyptian president tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is Al Fahmida in Tunis.
Stock prices rallied for the second straight day today as traders responded to the latest Federal Reserve move to lower interest rates and a rebound on the Japanese stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 30 points to close at 3,255.37. Advances led declines by a margin of more than 2-to-1 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 200 million shares. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin promised today to ease his economic reforms and to step down as prime minister by the end of the year. The pledge was part of a compromise that would allow Yeltsin to keep his power to rule by decree. Yeltsin threatened to call for a national referendum or even new parliamentary elections if the Congress of People's Deputies revoked his powers. The Bush administration says it will permit the state of Wisconsin to cut welfare payments to mothers who have more children. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The administration is backing the Wisconsin plan by granting the state a waiver to substitute state welfare laws for federal regulations. Under the Wisconsin plan, aid to families with dependent children will be partially capped after one child. The benefits could increase if the mother and father enroll in jobs programs or complete their education. They must also participate in sex education and parenting classes. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Lewis Sullivan, said the waiver for Wisconsin is part of President Bush's promise to reform the welfare system.
We're asking states to submit creative new ideas that help programs strengthen the family, that encourage personal responsibility, and that break the vicious cycle of welfare dependency.
President Bush called the Wisconsin plan a good example for the rest of the country. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
U.S. officials said today that the Organization of American States will probably approve a resolution calling for the return of democracy in Peru next week, but won't impose economic sanctions. A number of OAS ministers are in Washington now, preparing for a formal meeting of foreign ministers on Monday. The ministers are reported to be concerned that Alberto Fujimori's takeover of the Peruvian government could set back the trend toward democracy in Latin America. At the same time, U.S. officials said the OAS ministers don't believe that economic sanctions will do any good. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Director Roland Jaffe has chosen to make movies about morally complex subjects, and he shot them on location in physically challenging conditions. His film The Killing Fields described the mass slaughter of Cambodians under the Pol Pot regime. He shot the film in Thailand, where he replicated the mass graves. His film The Mission starred Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons as missionaries converting Indians in Latin America. It was shot in the jungle and on rivers with staggering waterfalls. Jaffe's new film, City of Joy, is set in the slums of Calcutta. It's based on a best-selling novel by Dominic Lacpierre. The film stars Patrick Swayze as an American doctor who loses his confidence after he loses a patient. He goes to India in search of spiritual guidance, but through a series of mishaps and coincidences, ends up working at a free clinic in Calcutta. The film was shot in Calcutta and features several prominent Indian actors. I asked Roland Jaffe why he's made films that take him far from home to developing countries.
It's a coincidence, but then, of course, when you look at any coincidence, you realize that there is a design to it. The rational reason, you know, the one that I kind of give in interviews like this, is that I say that basically it is the one problem we all have to come to terms with, is the cross-fertilization of cultures. If we don't learn how to do this, we don't enjoy doing this, if we don't make it into a growthful, beneficial thing to do, then we're going to face insurmountable problems. And therefore, I make films, I think, that are about that. But also, maybe in some unconscious way, I should have been a travel agent. I feel that a wonderful thing that movies can do is to take people to parts of the world they would never normally go. That, you know, you go to the cinema, and a movie will sweep you up and take you to a part of the world that normally would be beyond your reach, and will give you experiences and a way of looking at life that will enrich you as an audience, but won't endanger you.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading about some of the conflicts around the film. During the shooting in Calcutta, there were protests because some people didn't want the city shown as a hellhole. Some people resented having this expensive film made in their backyard about poverty. I understand the set was firebombed, and production was sometimes shut down by protests. Is that right?
We had every... the Indians are very, very inventive people, and they're very political people, very highly politicized. And demonstrations in Calcutta are to a penny, or to a rupee, I should say. We were making this film, remember, during the Gulf War, and it was very extraordinary to be in a sort of less industrially developed country while this Gulf War was going on. And so that made us very high profile. I remember one day being out on the streets, and there was a procession marching on the American embassy, and I caught the eye of a man in the crowd, and he looked at me and stopped for a second. Then he came over to me and he said, "Today," he said, "we march on the American consulate, but tomorrow we will read in the American library." And then he gave me a great grin and disappeared back into the crowd. And that's important because Calcutta is rich and complex and everything is politicized, but it's also intensely human. And it's Marxist controlled, and it always amused me that here we were making a film about the party, about the people that the Marxist Party was supposed to represent, and they were objecting to it. The Indian technique is to create a kind of political furore in the hope that the political furore itself will prevent any real discussion happening about something that they would like to prevent. But basically, the Calcuttans gave us an enormously good welcome. And only one bustee we were in, the man said, you know, you've come from 6,000 miles away to make a film here. We have politicians who don't even come 6 feet to visit us.
I was wondering if you ever went through some soul-searching during the shoot in Calcutta, thinking that here you were trying to make a socially relevant film about the poor of Calcutta, when at the same time some of the people of Calcutta saw the film as being the oppressor in a way, you know, rich movie coming in.
I know exactly what you're saying. And I won't say I soul-searched about it. I thought about it before I ever went and made the movie there. But you know, you couldn't take this seriously. The technique that Calcuttans use to block any apparent criticism of their city, though this film isn't critical of the city at all, is to create this kind of furore. They did it with Gunter Grass, who came to Calcutta and wrote a book called Stick Out Your Tongue. And the Calcuttans were furious about this book and started saying again, you know, this was oppression, this was capitalist oppression. They did it with Louis Malle when he made a film. They did it with Dominic Lapierre's book. They did it with Geoffrey Moorhouse when he wrote a book. Bengal is very, very defensive. Now, that's probably, in a way, could be fair until you understand who are the people who are being defensive. The only people who are being defensive are basically government ministers. The people of Calcutta itself aren't defensive at all. They live in that city. They love that city. They cope with that city. And they knew that we were making a film that honors their spirit. You see, this isn't a film about the poor. This is a film about people.
What were some of the difficulties of shooting in Calcutta, which, from what I know and from what you've shown in your movie, is a very crowded city, very narrow streets?
Well, there are the usual ones. I guess more than anything, you know, the Indians are insatiably curious. Magnificently curious. And here we were with Om Puri and Shabana Azmi, who are two wonderful actors and who are as famous in Calcutta, I guess, as if we were walking down a New York street with, Madonna and Robert De Niro. You know, the crowd would build up, and crowds in India are crowds. I mean, at one point we had about 10 or 11,000 people watching the movie. The problem was, when we allowed our extras onto the set, you know, to be the people we were working with, the crowd thought could see no difference between them and the extras. So they thought everybody was being allowed on the set, and suddenly one would discover that this carefully orchestrated scene with maybe 3,000 people now had 13,000 people in, all of whom wanted to crowd around the leading actors to ask for their autograph. The streets are narrow and they're crowded, and one has to be very careful of that. But at the same time, we found almost everywhere we went, the most extraordinary sense of welcome. I mean, I remember one house we were in, and I was looking at this house, see if it was possible to shoot, and an old man came out and asked what we were doing, and I explained that we were making a film, and we were considering using his house. What did he feel about that? And he looked at me for a long time, and he said, "Which studio?" And I said, "Well, I think it'll be Warner Brothers," which it was at that time. And there was a long pause, and he said, "I personally like Columbia." So, you know, the city is constantly surprising, and it's a wonderfully educated city. Like all cities, it thinks it's the center of the earth, and of course it isn't. But it's constantly surprising and constantly vivid, and as Max says in the film, there is something about that city that makes you feel more human and more alive, and that's what I wanted to honor in this picture.
There are a lot of lepers in the movie. Did you cast people who actually have leprosy?
Yes, we did. I went and visited Titigar leper colony, which is run by some priests and Mother Teresa. And that was a very, very moving experience. I was terrified when I went. I didn't realize how frightened I was until I got offered a cup of tea and found myself literally hesitating when I drank it. Well, nobody's ever got leprosy from a cup of tea, but this is what I had to surmount. But by the time I'd finished my visit, and I'd looked at the people, you know, not at the leper, not at the disease, so to speak. And I realized something very, very important, which was that these were people suffering from a disease that is actually curable. But what is really causing their agony is people's fear of them, not the disease itself. And at that point, I determined that they should have a voice in the film. And we have a real rickshaw puller in the film. And I thought, you know, we should have some. There are some lepers. And I asked them whether they'd like to act in a movie. And they looked a bit shocked, but thought about it and then said, yes, they would. And they are in the movie. And the marvelous thing about the movie is that it's very warming, I think, and touching. But at the same time, since you're in contact with people, it's very strengthening because you discover that, you know, disease, illness, muddle, poverty, whatever they are, cannot stand in the way of our understanding that we're dealing with people first and these other attributes come second.
How contagious is leprosy?
Well, it's not really contagious at all. It's infectious, but not contagious. In other words, it doesn't kind of run from one person to another like influenza might. Only about 5% of the population actually can catch leprosy at all. It's a viral disease. And what it does is it attacks the nerves. And because you get loss of feeling in the nerves, if you're poor and uneducated and frightened, if you cut yourself, you don't feel it, so you can easily get gangrene. You might pick up something that's too hot and burn yourself without even knowing it. So the deformities that come with leprosy are actually it's not the body rotting. It's the result of maybe gangrene or an accident. But leprosy is absolutely curable. I mean, a course of, you know, 50 or 60 tablets, and the disease can be arrested and can be reversed.
Tell me why you cast Patrick Swayze as the American doctor who's given up on being a doctor and goes to India looking for some kind of spiritual guidance and instead finds that he really is a doctor.
Well, I think, you know, the idea of the magician who can no longer do magic, or as it then became in sort of Chekhov's plays, you know, the doctor who can't heal, is a very, very touching character. And I love the idea that he was a Westerner who's psychologically wounded, as many of us can be in the West, running away from life and discovering that the very act of running away has taken him into the most alive country in the world, which is India, and then into the most alive city in the world, for good or bad, which is Calcutta. And I've always felt that Patrick was a fine actor. I thought that in Dirty Dancing, I could see there a man who would take risks, but I also detected a real honesty in what he did and a lack of affectation. And I felt that for this part, what would have to happen is one would have to have an actor with whom the audience begin to identify, because he takes us through this wonderful story. But it would have to be somebody who was brave enough to be honest. And that's what I found Patrick was. When he came to interview me with me, he said, I'm terribly nervous about this, and I don't know whether I'm a good actor or not. It's not really for me to judge. All I will tell you is I will give you my heart. I will be totally honest, and I will be part of the community. And I really liked the way he said that. You know, he'd just done Ghost. This was a major star, and he didn't have to say these things. And when he said them, I felt the truth of them.
I know sometimes directors are given an A-list by the studio of actors who are bankable enough to star in this film. Did you get a list like that with his name on it?
No, absolutely not. In fact, in some ways, the studios took the reverse line. I mean, they said, hey, why are you taking such a risk? You know, go with a more established actor. You're going to have a lot of trouble with, you know, the critics, because they won't forgive him for the fact that, you know, he's been in some movies that they haven't approved of. And I think as a director, you know, I have to take risks. I've always tried to take risks with my movies because you're doing it on behalf of the public. And I try to ignore where it's sensible, conventional wisdom. And it was conventional wisdom saying, don't use Patrick.
Oh, I want to get to the question of paying extras. In all of your films in third world countries, The Killing Fields, The Mission, and City of Joy, this is something you had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some kind of like a Hollywood Union scale that applies when you're working in the third world?
No, there isn't. And again, this is a case where one has to be intensely practical and not romantic. You know, the romantic view would be that we have to pay everybody, you know, the Hollywood scale. And of course, if you did that, you would unbalance things in the most terrible way. So what you have to do is you have to look at the average daily wage in the country, you know, what an extra would earn equivalently in America or in Europe, and then pay your Indian extras accordingly. There are unions in India. India's very, very heavily unionized. So we paid a little bit, you know, above the union rate, not so much as to cause embarrassment for other people, because you have to remember other films are being made, you know, other film units, Indian film units. So what you basically have to do is to look at the shape that the country gives you and learn to work with that.
When you say it would unbalance things if you paid a Hollywood wage in a third world country, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, imagine if you were an Indian filmmaker and an American movie arrived and suddenly paid people 50 times what you could pay to be them to be extras, your life would actually be made impossible. And, you know, you have to work with the rate of pay that people earn in the country. You can't, You can't just suddenly apply, because where do you stop? I mean, then do you give people health benefits? And did you see what I mean? You have to work with the country. On the other hand, there are things you add, like we had our own unit doctors, and I think people working with us got a degree of medical attention that they hadn't had before.
My guest is Roland Jaffe. He directed the new film City of Joy, set in Calcutta. He also directed The Killing Fields and The Mission. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Film director Roland Jaffe is my guest. I want to get to one of your earlier films, The Killing Fields, which was about Sidney Shamberg of the New York Times, who was a reporter in Cambodia, and his relationship with Dith Pran, who got caught in Cambodia when Pol Pot took over.
Right.
How did you create the scenes of The Killing Fields, the scenes of piles of skeletons and bodies? There's some pretty gruesome footage in that film.
Well, I looked at an enormous number of photographs and was amazed and shocked at what I saw. But in a way, with movies, you don't recreate exactly what you see. What I try to do is I try to recreate what it feels like. So I wanted to recreate not a sort of documentary sense of those killing fields. I wanted to create what it looked like to Pran. So I listened very carefully to things he was telling me. And then we just constructed images that I felt like him slipping into the pit and suddenly when he scrabbles around coming across something in the mud and then realizing little bit by little bit that there are bloated bodies in the water and things. That was done little bit by little bit to create in the audience the kind of emotions that Pran was feeling. But those were actually made by a very, very skilled Thai doctor who makes skeletons out of artificial materials so people don't have to use, real bones and buy real skeletons. And he worked with us and he made, 80 or 90 of these things and bodies in various stages of decomposition, etc. We actually planted a lot of that stuff in a shrimp field that we'd hired from a lady, but somebody had forgotten to tell her to move out of the shrimp field. So I'm afraid the poor thing came out at 6 o'clock in the morning to collect her shrimps, not realizing that the film unit had been there sewing their picture, and walked straight into this absolute mayhem. And it took us a long time to calm her down and convince her that these things were just plastic.
It's been a few years since I saw The Killing Fields, but as I remember, there are scenes where Dith Pran is starving to death.
Right.
And he eats insects because it's the only nourishment available.
Right.
How did you work that with Heng Noor, the actor?
Well, Heng, of course, had been through very similar experiences. In fact, we used to have some grisly but highly amusing conversations with Dith Pran and Heng Noor, where they would both talk about what they had survived on. And, of course, as the conversation got fuller, they decided they'd survived on less. And we went from eating, sort of land crabs until in the end people were eating the barks of trees. And it was very funny the way they were kind of topping one another in the horror of their diet. So nothing that we'd offer Heng to eat could be as bad as what he'd actually done. But, of course, we use plastic substitutes and things made up of food and, we wouldn't expect him to go through that experience again. But again, you just listen to what people tell you and listen to those stories. And then in film terms, you find ways of reconstructing that using your imagination, but creating a reality which conveys itself to the audience, but which doesn't have to be real in front of the camera.
I'm sure you've seen Spalding Gray's monologue, which was both a show and a movie called Swimming to Cambodia, that was in part about making The Killing Fields, because he was cast as an American diplomat in the film.
Right.
And it was one of his first, or perhaps his very first, movie role. So did you see the monologue?
Yes, I did.
Was it fun for you, or was it aggravating to hear somebody else tell their side of the story, which might have been very different than yours?
Oh, no, it was tremendous. Spalding's very, very funny.
He is.
My real panic was that he would muddle up the description that he made of me. He, He said that I had the eyes of Rasputin, the body of Zorro, and the heart of Jesus, and I was just petrified he wouldn't get it all muddled up, because I'm not sure I wanted the heart of Zorro, the body of Jesus. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, well, I don't know if you've seen his new monologue, but in this one he describes having to narrate swimming to Cambodia in the Soviet Union for people who are watching the film but don't understand English. Actually, it's translated by somebody else,
right.
You know, and the translator gets us all wrong, so I think in Russia your worst fears did come true.
No, don't. What agony.
In Swimming to Cambodia, Spalding tells the story of how he had to do one scene over and over and over again because he couldn't get his lines right. Mm-hmm. He's dyslexic and has trouble actually memorizing lines for a film. What's your memories of that scene?
Well, I think that's a pretty accurate record. The problem is I'm slightly dyslexic.
Are you really?
By the time Spalding had got his line wrong, and he said to me, but was it 11 B-52s or was it 52 B-11s? And I said, Spalding, don't ask me a question like that. Now I'm getting confused. I had to go back to the script. By the time we'd finished, I wasn't sure whether there weren't 11 Spaldings and one bomber, or whether a bomber had dropped Spalding over the set. All I knew was it was taking a hell of a long time.
Did you know that he had dyslexia?
No, I didn't. But then I think people who have it very often don't know that they have it. All I know is I seem to have caught it from him.
Would you work with him again?
Yes. He's such an inventive man, and he was tremendous fun, and he was just as much fun off the set as he was on it. I mean, wherever there was a bit of mayhem going on in the set, somewhere in the middle of it, looking totally innocent, was Spalding, and I found that just delightful.
Your movie, The Mission, was set in South America, and it's I forget which country.
It was supposed to be in Argentina, mm-hmm. But we in fact shot it most of it in Colombia and a little bit in Argentina and Paraguay.
And the movie is about the impact of politics and religion and missionaries on Indians from the country. You invited Dan Berrigan down as a kind of spiritual advisor, you know, to get some sense of context for the missionaries.
Absolutely.
And in his journal, in Berrigan's journal, he mentioned as a kind of aside that Robert De Niro had 24 armed guards keeping watch outside his hotel room for insurance purposes. The insurance company was afraid that he might be abducted or held for ransom.
Right.
So did you know when you went down with him that the insurance company was going to require such extremes?
Well, yes. The thing is that we found a set, a wonderful location to build that mission. The set was absolutely lovely, and we started building it when we discovered there was one slight problem, which was that there was a trail that went through the middle of it, which seemed to be used once a week. And it turned out to be, well, the stories varied, either a cocaine trail or a marijuana trail.
What's marijuana?
Pot.
Oh.
So it was certainly a drug trail of one form or another, and that led us into some very curious negotiations because we couldn't abandon the set now we had it. And Colombia is that kind of country. And I think what happened with De Niro was that basically the idea was to assign 5 guards to him, but then the insurance company said, but how do we know that of the 5 guards, those 5 guards couldn't be bribed and would turn into the kidnappers? So they brought in something called DAS, which was a secret service thing. And the DAS guys, those 5 DAS, looked after the 5 guys who were the original guys. But then there was a rumor that DAS maybe was a little corrupt. So they brought in another 5 people who were DAS, but didn't tell them that they didn't tell the others they were DAS. So they thought they were another group. And, you know, by the time we'd finished, I think most of the cast probably were working for the secret service.
How did De Niro feel about this?
Well, I think that a lot of it, I think he only thought that he had 5, and I tried to encourage it in that way. There were 5 who kind of stayed pretty close to him, and I pretended the others were basically, you know, that a lot of people stand around in Colombia to hold up walls that might fall down or look after people if they feel faint in the street. And you know, I think Bob maybe began to feel that Colombia was full of lonely men who were out to kind of help other people if they were in trouble.
Roland Jaffe, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Roland Jaffe directed the new film City of Joy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. British novelist Richard Rayner learned to lie when he was young to cover up for his father's absence. His father embezzled a small fortune and then staged his own disappearance. Now his father has more or less ended up in Rayner's new novel, The Elephant. Coming up, we meet Richard Rayner. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bruce Springsteen's two new albums. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In London, officials say at least two people were killed and dozens of others were injured in a bomb explosion. Earlier, officials said that they thought that there was more than one explosion, but later said that they believed a huge bomb went off in the city's financial district. A spokesman for Scotland Yard said that Waterloo Station received a telephone warning that a bomb in a van would go off in 20 minutes. And according to the Press Association, provided a code word used by the Irish Republican Army. The explosion occurred near the end of a day when Prime Minister John Major savored a victory by his Conservative Party in a general election that pollsters said yesterday was too close to call. NPR's John Edstey reports from London.
Through virtually all of the four-week campaign, John Major was shown in opinion polls to be losing the election. But a late swing to the Conservatives gave him a workable 21-seat majority in the House of Commons. Today, on the steps of the Prime Minister's residence, Major outlined his immediate objectives for Britain.
The first thing we must do is to move the country out of recession and back into growth. And then we must begin to extend those opportunities and those choices that make such a difference to people's lifestyle, such a difference to the way in which they live their everyday lives, free of interference from outside.
Neil Kinnock, whose Labour Party gained 40 seats, less than half the number needed to oust the Conservatives, said he'd have an announcement about his future on Monday. It's been widely speculated that Kinnock would lose his position as Labour Party leader if he failed to unseat Major. I'm John Itzty in London.
The Washington Post reported today that the accuracy of the F-117A stealth fighter and the Tomahawk cruise missile have been downgraded in the secret version of the Pentagon's report on the conduct of the Persian Gulf War. The Defense Department issued both classified and unclassified versions of the study. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
The 1,200-page report acknowledges a litany of failures and shortcomings. Some of Iraq's nuclear weapons facilities escaped damage because intelligence never located them. Some electrical power stations were repeatedly bombed by mistake. There weren't enough fast cargo ships to move armored forces to the Persian Gulf quickly, and not enough minesweepers to clear the way to the beaches. The ground war moved so fast that if it had gone on much longer, U.S. tanks would have run out of fuel. The report also emphasizes the unique conditions that contributed heavily to success, including a willing host nation, Saudi Arabia, which had surplus airfields and well-developed infrastructure, powerful allies, topography that exposed Iraqi forces to air attack, and poor Iraqi leadership, conditions the report warns that are not likely to be found again. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 30 points to close at 3,255.37 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Officials of the Bush administration have given Wisconsin permission to cut back payments to mothers on welfare. A waiver to the state will allow it to cut benefits to women who give birth to more children while getting welfare. Governor Tommy Thompson said that there is no evidence that unwed mothers have more children simply to get more money, but he said there is no evidence to the contrary either. Thompson said in the U.S., one of two children born in a one-parent household will end in poverty, but that 9 times in 10, a child born in a two-parent family will not. The plan will be tried for 5 years in Milwaukee and 3 other counties. H. Ross Perot, the wealthy Texan considering a run for the presidency, got a taste of what it would be like today as he fielded questions from newspaper editors in Washington on subjects ranging from the nation's deficit to drug use. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Perot outlined a 4-point plan that he says would eliminate the $400 billion budget deficit. He said he had not used marijuana or any other drugs, and he showed little patience for the kind of grilling he's likely to face if he runs for president when a questioner asked him what he'd do to fight drugs and hopelessness in the nation's cities.
Again, I've spent a lot of time on drug abuse. I've chaired a committee on drug reform in Texas.
I haven't heard it. What would you do? Let this audience know. I haven't heard it.
Do we have to be rude and adversarial? Can't we just talk?
Well,
Perot said repeatedly he is not anxious to be president and suggested today he has not changed that view. In fact, he said the more I'm in it, the less interesting it becomes. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The Belgium government has accused 4 Russian diplomats of spying and gave them 24 hours to get out of the country. Officials said that 2 of the 4 were embassy diplomats. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Children look to their parents to provide stability and structure. These are the last things Richard Rayner could get from his father. Rayner's father was a drinker, a womanizer, a con man, and embezzler who once faked his own death and disappeared for years. It's some story, and Rayner tells a fictionalized version of it in his new novel, The Elephant. This British writer is the author of one previous novel, Los Angeles Without a Map. Here's a reading from The Elephant about the son's first memory of his father.
I'm 4 years old, and he tells my mother he is stepping out of the house. We need some milk. He'll only be 5 minutes. He won't even take his coat. But soon it's 6 hours, 12, a day later, and still he hasn't come back. A policeman comes to the house and stares at my mother's legs as she gives her report and smiles uneasily when he sees I'm staring at him. He squashes my hair with a fat hand and asks if I would like to wear his helmet. It drops over my head onto my shoulders and suddenly I'm in a bell tower, dark and echoey, listening to his booming voice as it announces that there is nothing he can do, that it's a family affair, that in any case all Bradford knows Jack Hamer is a bad'un, but he always turns up in the end, more's the pity. After a week, we're short of money. While Helen and Keith are at school, my mother and I act as guides for an Irish piano tuner, blind, going with him from house to house to earn extra cash. One afternoon, as reward, my mother takes me to Lister Park, where there is a zoo and a snake, a python, I think, its once opulent skin now resembling a mouldy rug. Perhaps it doesn't like the cage. Perhaps it doesn't like Bradford. I remember thinking that either way I'd rather be the python than the hamster, white and gold and with brown eyes, and each air standing up on end, backed into a corner, waiting for its co-tenant to wake up and wonder about tea. After 22 days, my father comes back, with no explanation, but with a bottle of milk in either hand. He says, I got 2, just to be on the safe side.
It's Richard Rayner reading from his new novel, The Elephant. So is your first memory of your father the day that he disappeared?
My father's life, as I remember it as a child, was really a series of disappearances up to the big one that he pulled when I was 12, when he embezzled a large amount of money, faked his own death, and then vanished with it to South America, which tends to be where English people go when they do such things. But it's really true that my first memory of him is not actually his physical presence, but his absence, that he was just someone who, as soon as I became aware of him, he wasn't there. And as I say, that sort of throughout my early childhood, He would kind of go off for 2 weeks and then it would be a month somewhere else. And during all this time, my mum and all my brothers and sisters would be left alone in the house, and sort of we'd be wondering where he was, and eventually money would run out and my mum would have to kind of go out and get odd jobs to earn money and that kind of thing.
Is the story of your father a story that you had told over and over before you started to write about it, or is it a story that you had really tried to cover up?
Well, both. It's a strange thing. When I was a kid, I think children basically more than anything else want to be the same as other kids. And I was deeply shamed by my father's crime, which was reported in the newspapers and so on. And so basically all through school and all through university, I would say to people that he was dead or that he was working abroad or that I didn't know where he was or that he was living in Scotland and I hadn't seen him for years or he was working for BP in the Middle East or something like that. And it wasn't until I really became an adult and got to know him after he'd come back. So he vanished when I was 12 and came back when I was 22. I didn't really start to get to know him well until I was 26. And it was then that I realized how much, without knowing it, my own character had been shaped by this character who was never there in my life. And I suppose that's when I became obsessive about him. And at that time, I suddenly, having never spoken about my father to anybody, I became like the Ancient Mariner, you know, I kind of grab people and say, you have to listen to the story of my father.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Rayner. He has a new novel called The Elephant. Let's get back to your father's crime. When you were 12, your father embezzled a lot of money, faked his own death, and disappeared. So what was his crime?
The period that is completely fictional in the book is, he was one of these. And this character is sort of familiar from the John le Carré book, A Perfect Spy, which I deliberately never read. But there were a lot of people in the post-war generation in England, men who'd gone off and done very exciting things in their 20s. And my father was in the RAF and flew in missions in Lancasters. It's a very dangerous job, obviously. And he came back to Bradford, which is a small industrial city in the north of England. I guess its equivalent in the States would be something like Cleveland. And he inherited the family business, which was an undertaking business. Now, by the time I was born, that business had gone defunct, and the section of the book that deals with that is based all on my memory of stories that my sister told me. My sister, who I love and adore and is kind of one of the most heroic people I know, had kind of grown up and gone to sleep in coffins at night and stuff like that.
Because your father was an undertaker.
Right.
And ran the chapel in his living room.
Right. And but by the time I came along, that business was dead, and he had a variety of businesses, one of which was a garage. So he would receive cars from the then leading British auto manufacturer, British Leyland, which makes Austin and Morris famous British cars. And basically, he'd been running this business for sort of 4 or 5 years, so as far as they were concerned, he was respectable. And he just took delivery of about 60 or 70 cars and sold them very, very quickly and just pocketed the money and then did a bunk within, like, sort of 2 or 3 weeks.
My guest is Richard Rayner. His new novel, The Elephant, is based on his own relationship with his father, who was a con man and embezzler. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Richard Rayner. So after your father embezzled money, he faked his own death. How did he do that?
We had a motorboat, a motor cruiser, or a motor boozer, he used to call it, because he used to kind of get parties together and take them out, and everyone would get drunk and sex would ensue and stuff like that. And he left his clothes scattered around on the sea and then sank the boat.
Were you offended that he felt perfectly comfortable faking his death and going halfway around the world without saying goodbye or sending you some secret note or winking his eye in some way, you know, at you?
Not offended, messed up, hurt, sort of. But at the time, in the way that children do, I think children just deal with this stuff, and this is one of the things that I wanted to explore in the book, that all this bad stuff just happened in my childhood. And it was just like, okay, you know, this is obviously what everybody's life is like. This is the only life I have an experience of. Therefore, that must be the case. And it was only later that I realized that my soul, for want of a better word, had really been made dark by everything that had happened when I was a kid. And that was some of the stuff that I was trying to tap into and purge in the book.
What was it like the day your father reemerged?
Well, it was very... we heard that he was back, and there were rumours going around Bradford, and there was sort of a couple of stories in the paper about, is this character now returned? And he was, in fact, living up in Scotland at the time with another of his many mistresses, who's a very wonderful, lively lady called Maisie, who ran a hotel. And he came, he was arrested. He got shopped by a friend of his who told the Bradford police where he was. And so a policeman who had indeed made it his, or one of his professional missions to wait for my father, who was someone who had actually been at school with my father, one of these kind of great small town ironies, went up to Scotland and knocked on the door and said, Jack, you know why I'm here. So my father got sent to jail. And in fact, the first time I saw him, which was something that was such a kind of irony that I didn't use it in the fiction, was at his mother's, my grandmother's funeral, when he'd been let out of prison for the day. And this was, you know, his mum's funeral in Bradford, and we were all terribly upset and so on. And she had died never having seen him after he'd vanished for 12 years. So it was obviously a very distraught occasion. And I remember feeling completely unsurprised at seeing him, that he was just there. He looked very much the same as he had done. He'd lost some weight because he'd been in jail for a few months by then. And he just looked in great shape, you know. And we just sort of said hello very briefly. And then he was taken back to prison again.
Was there like a moment of reconciliation between the two of you, or was it some slow process?
That took years, really. And it kept seeming to happen. And then something would interrupt it, and kind of, he remained very proud and very difficult right up to the moment he died. And it took years. I went to see him, went to visit him several times in jail. And because he'd committed a white-collar crime, he hadn't hurt anyone. It had been a long time ago. He was put in an open prison in Lancashire, which is the sort of neighbouring county in England to where we were from. And this place was hilarious. I used to visit him there, and he turned it into a kind of comedy whenever I went, because he'd point out the other inmates, and there'd be journalists who'd sort of spectacularly embezzled their expenses, vicars who'd been exposed as kind of having it away with the church fund in the News of the World, which is the equivalent of the National Enquirer. So it wasn't exactly dark and desperate in there. And I suppose I saw him three or four times when he was in jail.
I guess, you know, if you were in business with your father, like your older brother was, you would have been in big trouble.
Heaven forbid, yeah.
But since you're a writer, I mean, and you're interested in fictions and odd twists of character. I mean, what your father left you was something that was actually very useful to you as a writer. You know, I mean, forgetting about the relationship.
Well,
beyond that, you know. but I mean, there was...
Well, as my father, there was a side of him that was ever the realist. He suddenly sat up one morning and said, "Boy, I realize you can make money out of this stuff."
There you go. Richard Rayner is the author of the new novel, The Elephant, which is published by Turtle Bay Books. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Neil Conan, who, as you may remember, covered the Gulf War for us, will have a report on the Pentagon, fessing up to the fact that some of the weapons used in the Gulf War did not really work as well as we were told at the time they did. We'll have a story from Illinois on Caterpillar and the dilemma of people trying to decide whether or not to take jobs as replacement workers and cross the picket line. We'll talk about the new airfares, about the British elections. The president has met with reporters today to talk about welfare reform and ended up talking about perks. And we'll also celebrate the anniversary of Casablanca.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been almost 5 years since Bruce Springsteen's last album. Now he has two new ones, Human Touch and Lucky Town, 24 songs that bring him into the 90s and which frequently reflect his status as a married man with two young children. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the albums. Here's If I Should Fall Behind from Lucky Town.
We said we'd walk together, baby, come what may. That come the twilight, should we lose our way? If as we're walking, a hand should slip free, I'll wait for you. Should I fall behind, wait for me.
For a guy who made his reputation as a Jersey Shore poet and thundering rocker, Bruce Springsteen's best music on Human Touch and Lucky Town comes in the form of ballads that avoid any undue sentimentality. It's as if he feels that his greatest challenge right now is to express how satisfying he finds his new marriage and fatherhood. That's a big risk for an artist like Springsteen, who, like all dedicated romanticists, always expects love to come at a price. On these albums, he makes a few sheepish remarks about living in a bourgeois house in the Hollywood Hills, about working for King Dollar, and being a rich man in a poor man's shirt. But it's not money, it's happiness he feels apprehensive, even guilty about on these records. Obscene wealth he's not afraid to name and take responsibility for, but happiness is far too new and fragile to get mauled by Springsteen's brawny music. When on that song, Living Proof, he refers to his infant son as a little piece of the Lord's undying light, crying like he swallowed the fiery moon, Springsteen bursts past any possible accusations of pretentiousness to describe delicate emotions that are rarely done justice in rock and roll. That tune is from Lucky Town, the better of these two releases, a collection of mostly small, intimate songs performed by Springsteen on guitar and Gary Malabar on drums. Human Touch, on the other hand, was cut with a small studio group that frequently sounds like a tinny, frantic version of the E Street Band and contains more throwaway material than Springsteen has ever released on one album.
Well, you can go out with him, play with all of his toys, but taking care of you, darling, ain't for one of the boys. Oh, there's something in your soul that is gonna rock. Loving you, babe, loving you, darling, loving you, woman, is a man's man's God.
Loving you's a man's job, baby. Loving you's a man's job.
That's Man's Job, and there's more macho bluster on Human Touch, like Real Man, as well as the one-joke novelty tune 57 Channels and Nothing On. But Human Touch can't be dismissed because it also includes the sweet folk lullaby Pony Boy and this austerely beautiful song, Cross My Heart.
First time I crossed my heart, I was begging, baby, please. At your bedside, down on my knees when I crossed my heart. It's when I crossed my heart. I crossed my heart, pretty baby, over you. Second time I crossed my heart, a rain came in from the south. Was lying there with something sweet, salty in my mouth. When I crossed my heart, when I crossed my heart, when I crossed my heart, pretty dark.
The first thing that strikes you about Human Touch and Lucky Town is how old-fashioned Bruce Springsteen sounds on them. All of his influences and reference points have remained fixed for years now. Phil Spector, Roy Orbison, the songwriting of Doc Pomus, Bob Dylan, and Lieber and Stoller. But sensible fans have given up on the idea that Springsteen is somehow going to advance rock and roll to a new stage. He's not interested in anything new at all. This is a guy who, on Real Man, refers to the movies as the picture show. He's probably one of the few people around who still uses the term real man with anything more than irony or sarcasm. Lucky Town and Human Touch suggest that Bruce Springsteen has become a fuddy-duddy. But he's our fuddy-duddy, and at times, he's a great one.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Now this beautiful river in the valley ahead, beneath the oak's bough, soon we will be wed. Should we lose each other in the shadow of the evening trees, I'll wait for you. Should I fall behind, wait for me.
Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell, Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a punk band in a post-punk era. We talk to two members of Fugazi, a band praised for its impassioned music and its resistance to commercialism. The band won't charge more than $6 per ticket, they sell their records at discount prices, and they've repeatedly turned down offers from major record labels. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.